Hello, family. My name is Blaine B. And I'm from the D. I was not originally supposed to be. Oh no, we're talking about Detroit. Don't get that mixed up now. We talking about Detroit. But we come here to serve. You understand what I'm saying? My name is Blaine B, and I'm a great recovering addict. I wasn't the original speaker that was supposed to have spoken, but on our way here from Detroit, we got a call from your program individual that said that they needed somebody to stand in and do this for recovery. Charlie asked me, and I was, you know, somewhat a little hesitant, but it's like I remind people all the time, how can you deny a program or a program that has saved your life? How can you deny a program that has given you everything that you have right now today? I just celebrated 28 years of recovery. On March the 28th, 1989, I made a conscious decision that I could no longer continue to use drugs, alcohol, or any other kind of mood or mind altering chemical. I consider myself fortunate because I have icons that I am associated with. I know we say we don't have these great images and persons that we're supposed to look up to, but I came up here with Donald H., okay, Charlie C.,
okay,
and about 15 other gentlemen. And I know out of the last 30 years of recovery, if you don't know Donald H. or Charlie C. in this program, I don't know where you done been. Because these guys have been in the program and carrying this message of recovery from the East Coast to the West Coast. I consider myself real fortunate to be associated with them. Also, as I was sitting down and trying to gather my thoughts for this conversation that I have with addicts, is I rode up here with 330 years of recovery. The individuals, the 15 individuals that we rode up in here with, our cumulative amount of clean time is 330 years. Now you do the math. I consider that real powerful. Because for people to commit themselves to a program that we done been prayed upon, we done been blessed, we done had holy water thrown on us, we done had every other thing done to us to try to get us to change our use of any mood or mind altering chemicals. That being said, I always like to preface my talks with this excerpt from How It Works and Why, Step 10, which is my favorite step. And the reason why this is my favorite step is because I came out of prison in 2004 after having been 12 years clean. My two greatest fears in recovery was going back to the penitentiary clean and having a critical illness where I ended up taking some type of narcotic drug. I started shooting dope when I was 15 years old. But this is what this piece says. It says, our experience tells us that some members relapse, even after long periods of clean time. And you know what that tells me? That I cannot afford to take this blessing that I got for granted. And that I need at all costs to protect what I have under all circumstances. It says, because we have become complacent in recovery. And what that means to me is that I done got so much recovery and got my life so together, now I don't identify and relate with y'all no more. I know y'all got the members in y'all's area that's been got 10, 15, 20 years of recovery, and all of a sudden they feel like they got a life. I'm tired of being around you damn addicts and hearing all that bullshit about getting high. They told me that members that continue to make meetings on a regular basis, they have a tendency to probably stay clean. That's the reason why I stay here and why Detroit has the greatest number of older members that are continually still active in our recovery community in Detroit. You'll find on the average of 15 years or more of individuals that are still actively involved in recovery. It says that we allow their resentments to build and refuse to acknowledge their wrong. See, you know, we tend to want to have find a pretext on why we don't want to identify and relate no more. You know, we get the cars, we get the houses, we get the jewelry, we get the clothes, we get the relationships, and we decide, nah, I don't need y'all asses no more. When I need to be sitting down at a goddamn table before, because I got social acceptability today. I got social acceptability. I got my shit together. I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan. I got my master's degree in 1992. Which is approximately 25 years, and after being 3 years clean, I was sitting at this podium like this at the University of Michigan in Rackham Hall being the graduating speaker. And Charlie reminded me of that. He said, man, you was a graduating speaker at the University of Michigan. You don't have no problems with getting up. You shouldn't have no problem getting up on a podium. See, because this right here is a hell of a damn responsibility to get up here and share your strengths, your hopes, and your recovery. Because, see, what you're sharing has a profound effect upon the individuals that's listening to what you're talking about. See, I ain't better than nobody in this room. I have to keep myself constantly humble and remember that at any time, because I done had it happen to me clean, you can be up here today, and tomorrow, all that shit is gone. I was sitting in a parking lot in 2000. One of my fantasies on being clean was I was able to handle dope without getting high. Every dope addict, one of their fantasies, especially those of us that use heroin, feel like I need to be able to handle that. See, but it's a consequence behind you handling shit like that. See, when they rolled up on me, I'm on the telephone talking shit to a female, getting ready to go to a Dacna fundraiser and anticipating my shit. I got a car full of dope in the trunk, weed in the back, heroin in the front, a 40 cal Smith & Wesson in the front. Y'all remember Nate the Matrix, right? When my man told Nemo, he say, when they was caught up in there, if you see that black cat go back and forth between them, then you know, oh boy, them coming for your ass. I seen that black cat. It wasn't a black cat. It was two patrol cars that something told me, say, something about this shit, boy, ain't right. And I had to sit up in the car. I said, well, hold on, baby. I'm going to have to get back with you because I can see it's getting ready to be some shit going on here. And I'm sitting up in a school parking lot, and I'm like, shit, I know ain't nothing getting ready to happen. I'm straight. I done gave the undercover police $3,000, and he's supposed to have been coming back. I mean, we get stuck on real stupid. It's like, God damn, man. You know what I mean? And that's another thing. You know how we fantasize that we was this hell of a motherfucking hustler and player and shit. And then when we look objectively at who we really was when we was getting high, we find out, man, nigga, you wasn't nothing but a petty ass goddamn thief trying to get one more to keep getting high. We sit up and then fantasize and then romanticize our motherfucking addiction. But when I seen that black cat roll around, the next thing I know, they had me handcuffed to the steering wheel of the car and asking me to tell on some motherfucker. That ain't in my DNA. That wasn't never in my DNA. If I always got knocked for something I did, I took my own way. But you know how some of us is when we're giving an out on some shit. We gonna take it and run with it. But something about that goes against the grain with me. You know what I mean? They say, well, you looking at 40 years. If you just buy a half a key of dope from these guys and we can act like it ain't never happened. But see, it don't work like that. We can't act like something didn't never happen when it did. How am I going to say that how can I live with myself and live with the potential harm that could come to my family if I tell on the wrong person? It says, little by little, those small hurts, half-truths, and justified grudges turn into deep disappointments, serious self-deceptions, and full-blown resentments. See, we good at self-deception. We good at turning the truth. They say we can turn the truth into the most far-fetched things. When I got into this program of recovery in 1989, I was not playing. This is serious for me. This is a life and death proposition. This is not about me making a decision. After I seen all the stuff I done seen in this program, I'm grounded and rooted in this shit. I can't see out of the relationship that I have with people in this program about going back out. I mean, I'm 62 years old, right? What it looked like? I mean, think about this. Dig this here. A 62-year-old dope fiend out there with them young boys now trying to get high. Get your old ass up out of here, you old motherfucker. For real? Yeah. Another one of my favorite steps is the third step, which goes hand and foot, I believe, with the 10th step. About making a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God, as I understand. See, we have some shit that comes up in this process of recovery. You know, a lot of us is under the self-deception that once I get clean, everything gonna be a flowery bed of ease. It don't work like that, y'all. See, what happens is life on life terms pops up. And the thing, the essence to recovery is when these things pop up, how am I going to deal with them? Am I going to stay committed to this lifestyle, or am I going to use this as a pretext or excuse to go back out and pick up and use? And we talked about our concept of God. It says here that our concept of God comes not from church dogma, but from what works for us. What works for you. It says here that many of us understand God simply as whatever force that keeps us clean. I was telling the addict earlier today, they had a situation came up where they was disappointed in it. Because we're going to come up with some disappointments, y'all. We're going to come up with some serious disappointment. And see, either the program going to kick in or we're going to go back out and do some other stupid shit. It says here that we found that all we needed to do in this program was to try. I had a therapist that I worked with at a methadone clinic when I first got clean named Rudy Bates. He said, trying is lying. You either going to do this or you're not. It's just that plain and simple. Ain't no ifs, ands, buts. And I was telling the addict, they was talking about they got some reservations in the back of their mind. If you got the smallest, if you got a mustard seed of an inkling of going back out there and finding some reason why you can use, some excuse you can use, you're not committed to this. You just a time bomb waiting to go off. It says, when we gave our best effort, the program worked for us as it has worked for countless others. I seen this program work for my predecessor. I seen my predecessors face issues and situations, and they did not use that as an excuse to go back out and pick up. I got a predecessor or one of my peers that came with me that faced stage 4 cancer. Now, you know, we always set up that situation in our mind of what would be a reason why we would go back out and pick up and use. If my mama died, if my brother died, if I had a limb cut off, you know, we always got something in the back of our mind, or some of us do, a reason why we would go back out and pick up and use. I ain't got no excuse. I belong seriously to the no matter what fucking goddamn group of alcoholics. ain't no excuse. I done been through all kinds of shit. And here recently, I have my own business. I have a Medicaid business in Detroit that deals with infants and pregnant women. And I was going up the stairs to my office, and I had gotten to the point where I was having real serious shortness of breath. And my wife kept telling me, she say, won't you go to the hospital and have it checked out? And you know how we do. Oh, no, it ain't nothing but the flu. I'm gonna get over it. We self-diagnosing our asses like we Ben Casey, the motherfucking doctor and shit. Y'all, the older people in this room, those people that can identify who Ben Casey was, you know how old their asses is. But I finally decided that I was going to listen to what the hell she said, right? So I go to Sinai Grace Hospital, which is about 2 blocks around the corner from my job, and got admitted immediately into the hospital. I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. I say, damn, I stayed in the hospital for a week. Them pumping the fluids out of my lungs and whatnot. And then shortly after that, I had a relapse. Because, of course, they tell me don't drink no pop, cut down on your fluids, and I'm saying, fuck you, I'm going to go ahead and do what the hell I want to do. So now the doctors say, well, we got to do something a little bit. We got to do some surgery now. We got to put a defibrillator, pacemaker in your heart. I'm saying, what the fuck, man? Putting a pacemaker, a defibrillator in my heart? And see, my shit wasn't working right. And I was like, damn, is it that serious? They had the operation, but my cardiologist didn't put the damn thing in right. I was sitting up here with a lump about an inch high from the damn defibrillator pacemaker being put in my heart. So now I got to go to another doctor to put a third lead onto my heart. I said, damn, man. That first time I went in, man, you know, I struggled with the recovery. I went back in this time, and this was more serious because they had to go through my lungs and whatnot. And they gave me narcos. They gave me Dilaudids. They gave me morphine. Here go a goddamn dope fiend, heroin addict. And they done gave me damn near every motherfucking narcotic on the map. I really struggled with the recovery. And I say I struggled with the recovery because my wife, and this is this program, man, these addicts, They showed up, man. I needed some serious prayer. They showed up, say, hey, God ain't through with you yet. I hit a real dark space in this recovery. I don't know if any of y'all ever, I've been pronounced DOA on arrival to Hurley Medical Center at the age of 16. And I don't know if anybody ever seen that dark spot. And it scared me because it was like I was gonna make a transition. And these addicts, I mean, addicts showed up that I don't even mess with. I mean, seriously, this is how powerful this program that we involved in works. Because, see, we can get some help from the least amount or from the least person that we think that we can't get nothing from. It tells us in our literature that we can get something. The newcomer can tell us something. We don't get so grandiose and so big in this program that where we lose our humility. I pray constantly, God, give me, keep me humble. Don't let me forget where I came from and what I've been through. These addicts showed up. They prayed for me. My youngest brother prayed for me fervently. I couldn't get up out the bed. My wife say, baby, come on. Come on, get up. And I was crying. And she say, what's wrong? I say, I ain't never, ever been this weak in my life. When you used to being vibrant and doing what the hell you want to do, to be laid on your back like that for a week in intensive care, man, that's a hell of a humbling experience, man. I got a program to do. The reason why I stay around here, because I'm going to tell you, just like most of us dope fiends, if I ain't getting no benefit out of it, I ain't staying. I ain't staying around here if I can't see no benefit in this shit. But from the time I came through the door in 1989, I seen some benefits in this shit. And I'm talking about I seen some immediate benefits in this recovery thing. And that's the reason why I stayed. I've been to the penitentiary 6 times. I got what's called an F number. In Michigan, they give you A, B, C, D, F. And when I got to the D prefix, the psychiatrist say, D is for dumb, E is for extra dumb, and F is that you a pure D fuck up. You don't have no reason for continuing to put yourself in harm's way of jeopardizing yourself coming into the penitentiary. Because it wasn't because I was dumb or illiterate or dyslexic or nothing like that. I was just caught up so deeply into this. I was so immersed into this lifestyle. But what happened is I started finally recognizing the damn connection between the dope and the prison sentence. That was my first awakening. I found out that when I stopped getting high, I stopped getting locked up. I said, wow, for real? Then once I understood that dynamic in relationship, then I could justify not getting high because I ain't had no more excuses. The God of my understanding helped me to have this awakening. It was a powerful awakening because, you know, like I said earlier, our people try everything to get us to change, man. And it's like we'd be so caught up in the grip of the getting high. We'd be locked and loaded. Like, you know, fuck what you talking about, man. I got you, anything. If I can do anything, to get high. And once I found out that if I could do, like I say, all we got to do is try. Once I found out that I put some effort towards being clean, I started seeing some revelations. I started seeing some results in this shit. You know, I got clean. I got my bachelor's degree in 91. I was motivated. I was empowered. I said, "Ooh, shit! I got my bachelor's degree." I started working in a methadone clinic in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the University of Michigan is located. And I got empowered to think that, okay, well, maybe you can get a master's degree now, because the bachelor's really ain't gonna pay you like you're supposed to get paid. I've got to admit, I wanted to get the master's degree. I wanted to help us, but I wanted to help me too. And when I first went over to the University of Michigan, it was this real powerful black lady, real polished, smooth, that told me, say, "I don't care about your motivation and exuberance and shit. You need to come back with something else other than your good wishes." And I was hurt. I was crying. And I said, "Okay, you got me mixed up. You don't even know who you're dealing with." I came back a year later and got a full scholarship and full ride to the University of Michigan. See, this is what you're capable of doing if you really committed to this program. Here go a motherfucker that's been to the joint 6 times. Got every kind of case that you could think of except for rape and murder. Anything to get one more. And like I said, the reason why I stay around here is because of results like that. I went from that to being the closing speaker for our graduating class, and man, when I figured that, I was empowered. I was motivated to stay here. And my life has progressively gotten better. But I want to thank y'all. I want to thank this committee for allowing me to stand in and carry this message, because this is the most powerful thing that we can do. Everybody's message is valid. I don't discount nobody's message. I don't care who it come from. I might not want to hear it. But you know how you be at a table and you keep hearing the same thing? Oh, I stick to the table till the bitter end, man. Because I don't know. At the end of that table, that person might be done told me something that can help me with the dilemma I'm facing. My name is Blaine B., and I'm from the D., and that don't stand for Delaware.